Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. This is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is another episode of our series on the war in Vietnam. And during this series, we are looking more at personal aspects of the war rather than political aspects of the war. And we've done a series of interviews with veterans. And I have several friends here on Vashon Island. And Greg McElroy is one of those. And I asked Greg, I said, do you know any vets on the island that would be willing to come on the show? And so that's our guest today. His name is John Burke. And I asked McElroy, I said, you know, you think he'll be a good interviewer? And he'll keep talking. And he said, just got to shut him up. So that's kind of where we are with that. So I figured, you know, that's what I like. And he's also a teacher. And, you know, and I taught for 50 years. And I also know with teaching that, you know, it is the gift of gab. And I used to present many times to administrators. And administrators don't like to admit they don't know anything. And I could tell them about the new law that required that on Thursday, once a month, you had to come to school without a shirt. And they'd all look at each other and say, oh, yeah, we're aware of that law. We've seen that many times. So with that, I'm going to start talking to Mr. Burke. And so, first of all, John, one of the things that really interested me about your story was that you were there. You know, most of the guys that graduated with me, I'm much younger than you, and you know, graduated in that 66 to 68 era, where out of 80 males in my graduating class, 35 wound up either being drafted or enlisting in the service, and you were actually before that time. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I got out of high school and started junior college. I was going to school, working, playing, working, going to school, and mostly not doing so much with college, but I'd already had a deferment. So as a result, I knew that if I dropped out of college, I was going to have to do my military stint, and I wasn't going to get away from it. Didn't have a problem with that, but I'd already seen the Air Force, and the Air Force in the middle of wintertime in western New York was going to send me to Lackland, Texas can be anything from snow to heat wave one day after the other. Navy would have sent me to Great Lakes, which was cold, and I was walking around in the snow already. Army would have sent me to Fort Dix, which was the same way. But the Marine Corps was going to send me to the sunny south. We're talking mint juleps and magnolia trees.
And mint juleps.
Oh, yes. And mint juleps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I got off the train at Yamasee, South Carolina, to be met by the first snowstorm in South Carolina in 50 years. And we didn't have extra blankets. So much for getting away from the snow.
And so much for your your luck to that point, being involved with the military?
Well, I'd been a cadet in Civil Air Patrol when I was a kid, so I already, and this leads into some other stories, because I understood the military psyche, and you kind of learned to give them what they wanted and be what they wanted while they had you, and just not be too excited about that.
Go with the flow.
Yeah, but knowing the psychology, the military psychology, which I learned at 13 years old, standing out as a cadet with no winter clothing in the middle of wintertime in upstate New York, I was used to that.
Where were you in New York?
Outside of Rochester.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, that can get real cold. I have friends that live in Syracuse, and weather can change about 50 degrees in about 2 hours. So.
Well, that stretch between like Michigan City, Erie, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse actually gets more snow than any place else in the United States under, say, 10,000 feet on the average.
Yeah. And he's an orthopedic surgeon, and he was also saying that the big thing now is to go bar hopping on snowmobiles, which provides a lot of broken leg surgeries for him. So anyhow, so tell me, when you what were your first impressions when you did you come by a boat to Vietnam? Did you come by plane? How did you get there? Swim?
Well, they'll tell you that we officially went into Vietnam in July of 1965. I was in the 1st Marine Unit that officially went into Vietnam in July of 1965. We landed in Da Nang. However, I had been in country a year before that. We were theoretically active Marine Corps in there, but we were there. My battalion and the company team, and the company team before them out of 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, had dug the first trenches at Khe Sanh.
Ah.
So we were theoretically there to provide security for a helicopter squadron, Marine helicopter squadron, that was ferrying Arvins, but they were technically non-combatants. The real reason we were there was the little concrete block hut down at the end of the airstrip, bristling antennas, that was an ASA listening post, but they didn't tell us that.
And Arvin's are Army regular Vietnam?
Arvin was the Army of Vietnam.
Republic, I guess.
The Army of the Republic of Vietnam, which was the South Vietnamese
right.
Army.
Right. And so... And Khe Sanh was one that had a major siege on it. That was probably during the first, Tet in 68.
That was later. So that was 68 Tet. And I was gone by then. That was a major start of the, I got to tell you, victory for the North Vietnamese in Vietnam was Tet 68.
There have been a few, And also, when you landed in Vietnam, I've asked everybody this, what was your first impression when you hit ground and set foot on Vietnam?
When we got to the beach in Da Nang, we did a usual Marine Corps amphibious landing, jumping out of the landing craft and, you know, scurrying up the beach to be met by a bunch of people in lounge chairs, drinking whatever they were drinking, watching us come ashore.
Wow. So Annette Funicello did not rush to you and or Bobby Darin and do things like that.
You're dating yourself, Steve.
Yeah, I am.
So you're talking about Annette, who was our girl on the Mickey Mouse Club back
then.
That's
right. Yeah,
kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know that Walt Disney would not let her wear a bikini.
Well,
he only allowed her to wear a one-piece bathing suit.
Because Annette was actually on the Mickey Mouse Club, I believe, playing a girl who was maybe 3 years younger than she actually was.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I have a joke about that, but we won't do it on
okay,
air.
Okay, yes. Good old Annette. Anyhow, I'm losing it here myself. But
sorry to bring up those memories, Steve.
No, that's all right. I saw Beach Blanket Bingo several times.
Okay, I'll be a straight guy.
That's right. Okay, you'll be the straight guy. When you got there, was there training for you in the country? Did you kind of hit the ground running?
Before we did that, we were the float battalion, the 7th Fleet in the Pacific. The U.S. Navy 7th Fleet has a ready-to-go Marine Corps landing team with them at all times, and the battalions rotate in this duty. So we had the duty, and we went into the Philippines. We were told, the troops were told that we were going to be in the Philippines at Subic Bay for at least 15 days. I was in battalion intelligence, and we were making up operations orders for a survival exercise in northern Luzon, but we were told we were going to be there the whole 30 days of the float. We went into town, and if you'd been any place in the Philippines previously, you'd go into town, and if you didn't have any money, you were going to get paid in a week or so. You go into the bars and tell Mama-san that, you know, we need a loan. You know, we need a tab for a week. And nobody ever ran out on bar tabs in the Far East because your buddies would come get it from you because they didn't want to lose that privilege. So we went into town first night in Olongapo and tried to get credit in the bars because we got paid the next week. Mama-san said, no, you go 3 days. And they said, no, we're going to be here for, a couple of weeks. We were allowed to say that we were going to be there for a couple of weeks. And she said, no, you be gone 3 days. Now, I knew I had just made up an operations order for 10 days in northern Luzon. So we weren't going to go away. So we went out next day, took helicopters up, and doing the survival exercise. Great time running around with the little Negritos in the hills and, a bag of rice and a machete, and we had to survive for a week. It was a lot of fun, except that 3 days later, helicopters came in, picked us up, and we had 1 hour to get our stuff on the ship, and we were steaming out of Subic Bay. So hearing on the radio that we were reacting to being attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Oh, at that time.
Well, yeah. So here we're steaming out. Now, the problem was, in terms of veracity, that our laundry went into Manila. And at that time, on the dirt roads around from Subic to Manila, it took a full day to get it in there and a full day to get it back. When we got down to the dock on supposedly 1 hour's notice, our laundry, which wasn't supposed to be back for 3 days, was waiting for us on the dock.
Wow.
Everybody in the Philippines, every mama-san, every restaurant owner, whatever in the Philippines, knew that the Tonkin Gulf thing was going to happen.
Wow.
So this has been, since then, with the release of the Pentagon Papers, this has been verified, but we all knew it then.
Yeah. Interesting. That part with the machete and the bag of rice sounds like Vashon with only two fairies, kind of the same thing there. So then you went to Vietnam and...
Before we had been float battalion, we'd been into Quezon, and then after float battalion, we came back and we occupied a position outside of Da Nang until the end of November of 1964, and then we came back stateside then. So I'd already been in country for, a tour before I came back to the States.
Was there, when you were in there at that time, was there still lots of activity by enemy troops and things, or?
Yeah, it was. Basically, we were dealing with mostly Viet Cong, which were South Vietnamese, Vietnam Cong Shan, or the Vietnamese communists. They were starting to be supplied by the North Vietnamese, but mostly we were dealing with local Viet Cong.
So it's kind of small bands or small groups.
Yeah, a lot of booby traps.
Kind of hit and run.
We were losing 30 to 35 people out of the battalion wounded every month, just mostly from booby traps.
Yeah. You know, one of my friends that graduated with me, young Native American kid named Alan Aronica. He was there and kind of didn't know what he was getting into. And he said he was walking on the top of a rice paddy and hit a fish line cut on the hooks in his boot. And it pulled, as I understand it, could be incorrect, but kind of pulled like a hand grenade out of a can.
Yeah.
So the pin went off. He said, fortunately, he was a little clumsy and he tripped forward. And so the blast pretty much, you know, went over him. It was, I think that was the first of his two or three Purple Hearts. Were you out in the bush very much, or did you?
I was in the bush all the time.
All the time.
I was a battalion scout, which became the scout sniper position.
So, uh-huh.
I'd been a team shooter, and when I was in California, Western Division matches, I shot Far East matches, worked with a guy named Gunny Hurt, setting up the sniper school on Monkey Mountain for Marine scouts at battalion level back during Korea, I believe, but at least Second World War, were also snipers, and they'd gotten away from that designation and they got back to it. So the position is now scout sniper. We were basically points on all the patrols.
Right. And one of my friends that I taught with first year in Highline was he was a scout, but he had a German Shepherd. There was quite a group of them that he would go out with, I think he said, a communications person and, go out, and the dog would detect motion or, you know, scent of somebody out there, and then they would report that back.
Yeah, we brought in dogs like second and third tour that I was there.
Yeah.
They were great. Dogs are great. We'd have to take them, especially German Shepherds. We'd have to throw them in the creek every once in a while because they get too hot. But they, yeah, dogs are great.
Yeah, that's what he mentioned. They were not your family pet. They were not trained to be, at least where he was. He had a picture of him, in a hospital. And he was trying to give the dog, they were supposed to give the dog, check the temperature every week. And dog didn't like that and attacked him. So he said that, but he said the dog was very effective for, you know, being able to just smell 10,000 times better than anybody else could and could really detect that.
My last tour, I wound up being attached to a MACV unit. It was five Rangers and an Aussie warrant officer and I, and the Aussie and I had been there attached to this district for a couple of months before the Rangers came out. And the Ranger captain had a big German Shepherd. Now, this wasn't a trained German Shepherd, right? It was just his big German Shepherd. And this dog used to get steaks delivered out from Da Nang. And the Vietnamese we had a bunch of PFs and RFs, regional forces people, and they would watch this dog and this captain, this ranger captain, said, oh, yeah, they're all scared of my dog. Yeah, they're terrified of my dog. They're terrified. And the Aussie and I looked at each other and said, they're just eyeing the biggest dog that they've ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, one night the dog disappears. And the rangers are all worried and they're going around looking for the dog. The Aussie warrant officer and I found the right hut and we sat and ate German Shepherd and drank rice wine all night.
Ah, yeah. That's veal in Vietnam, I thought. Maybe, but...
Well, it isn't most of the Far East. The dog is a delicacy, but you only eat it half of the month. It's lucky to eat it half of the month. The other half of the month, not lucky.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. We used to... In Ellensburg, I used to go out hunting with a friend, Alan Aronica's, another Native American guy. His name was Kenny Walker, who has passed away. And our Indian name for him was the Hawk Eater. But he would take us out hunting, and he could make a meal out of anything. And he would, one time we had a porcupine that he cooked. That he said was extremely, it was really, really good. But he said the one thing he had to be aware of was that the porcupines would eat the bark on trees. And you had to make sure that they hadn't been eating pine trees. Because then it tastes like a fillet of whatever you call it, a Vicks Vapo Rub. Yeah, so.
Well, Oregon... Oregon State had a law, at least up to the 70s, if not now, that it was illegal to hunt porcupines. And the basis of that law goes back to the 1800s, because if somebody was caught out in the woods and they were lost or they were starving, porcupine is one of the easiest things to catch because they're really slow. So they wanted to leave the porcupines in case there were people out there that needed to eat.
Yeah, they're not the fastest. My dogs have run into a few porcupines.
I've picked, you know, many porcupine quills.
Yes, yes. Dogs. Yep.
Yep.
So so you were there, how many years were you in Vietnam?
Well, the way they figured tours was between certain dates. So I've got, technically, I've been there four tours, but that wasn't 4 years. It was about 2.5 years total.
I love euphemisms in the United States, you know, passed away for died or croaked. And I like tours of, you know, the veterans that had tours of Vietnam. I mean, it sounds like, you know, going on a tour to Tulalip or to... you know, some other place, and it probably wasn't very much fun for most people.
Well, we didn't have an open bar of daiquiris.
Yeah, that's right. No hot tub. Of course, you didn't need the hot tub there, but.
Well, at one point we were getting a ration of 2 beers a day, theoretically, and all the good beer wound up staying back in the what we call the REMP area, R-E-M. I won't go into that.
Okay.
So the people that were in the rear, and we got stuff like Texas Lone Star.
Texas Lone Star, there's a warning in the label that says not to be taken internally.
So, yeah, I can believe that.
It's pretty bad.
Like, but we got Vietnamese beer too.
So. Yeah, we drank Schmidt beer, $1.09 for a 6-pack of 16 ounces. So, anyhow, well, we've discussed the drinking patterns in Cambodia and the Philippines and Vietnam, but tell me, when you came back to the United States, what was your experience like? You came back. Where did you fly into, or where did you come back to?
San Diego.
Uh-huh. And then did you take a bus someplace or?
No, actually, so I had been extended. My last time overseas, I'd been going to language school. I was short course from Monterey, and I tried to get Chinese, and they wound up giving me Vietnamese. But I had less than a year to do. So at that point, if you had less than a year to do, you didn't go back to Nam. So I figured I'd be teaching language to people that were going over. They pulled us out the day before graduation, all the Marines. We were back on a ship that night, headed out of Long Beach, going back to Nam. And wow. I said, well, I got less than a year to do. And they said, no, you don't. Navy and the Marine Corps both got extended. The two-year Army people didn't, but it didn't matter how long an enlistment you had in the Navy or the Marine Corps, you got extended. So, wow.
So you wound up going back.
Yes, and I wound up doing all of my extension in country. Wow. I was 3 months over my end of enlistment when I finally got back to the States.
When you eventually got, did complete all your tours and came back to the United States, were you glad to be back? Did you feel bad that you couldn't be with the people you'd been with in Vietnam? Or what was your reaction to that?
Well, I was glad to be out of Vietnam as a conflict. I had been watching what was going on from the first time I was over there, and become totally convinced it was a waste of time. We were getting a bunch of people hurt and killed for no reason at all. We were supporting the wrong side. And as soon as I got back, I got very involved in the political side of getting us out of the Vietnam conflict.
Yeah.
So I had a chance to talk to people, and a lot of guys came back and they just clammed up and didn't talk to anybody. In my case, I wound up spending a lot of time explaining what I'd seen and what I felt and what my impressions of our involvement were. So I got a chance to talk it out.
One of the things we've talked about with a lot of the vets is the fact that, have you been back? Have you seen the wall? Have you been back to D.C. and seen the wall?
I have, but the first time I saw it was when they had the traveling wall that came to Seattle Center.
Uh-huh.
I got to tell you, yeah, I saw it and found names and went out and sat on the steps for about half an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me. I've been back to D.C. many times and seen many of the monuments. But to me, because it's so stark and dark, and that it starts out, with the first years that people were there.
Yeah.
And as more people were killed, it kind of goes up to a point. And one of the things that I think the a lot of the vets have talked about is, there were 58,000 people, military, U.S. military killed in Vietnam. But then you multiply that by family members. I've been to the memorials here on Vashon and, seen parents and, that are, very old now, but, you look at you look at the extension of how that affects, it's more than 56,000 people dead. It's a lot bigger than that. And it just seems like, again, maybe I'm getting political, but it seems like war is kind of a dumb way to try and settle things. I mean, there ought to be, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, we're not getting into the political side of it, or I could go on for about 3 hours about mistakes we made in our diplomacy and our relationship with the Far East ever since 19, quite frankly, 44. So,
yeah. So it is interesting too, because, I can remember it was almost propaganda at that when I was a kid, and back at that time, you'd go to the movie, you'd see the newsreel, and they'd show the dominoes. Going down.
Yeah.
And so it was, they made it so much like World War II in looking at body counts and those kinds of things that it was looked at many differently. So anyhow, that just about wraps up our time. And maybe we can go across the street and have some Vietnamese beer. No, I guess that would be Vai Chon beer. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Thank you, John, for coming and sharing your sage knowledge. Thank you, Rick, for sharing your ability at the board. And we will talk to you later. Have a great day.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.